I really appreciate the very warm and kind introduction. My mom would be very proud. So, so as mentioned, I'm going to talk today. First of all, I'm going to give a talk that I largely give to clinicians. So those of you all that are rigorous data scientists that are developing your own models, like, give me a little bit of leeway at the beginning of the conversation because I'm going to try to do some level setting. I think for this audience, a lot of people know a lot of this topic, but I will tell you that still for a lot of clinicians out there, they don't necessarily have a great grounding in the difference between, say, simple machine learning techniques like regression versus deep learning techniques versus generative AI. So we'll touch on that a little bit. And then what I mostly want to focus on is even though I'm an internal medicine physician, I spent a number of years as a technology leader within the imaging space just by a strange turn of events. And so I watched as convolutional neural networks sort of made their way through radiology and kind of, I don't know that I have the slide here where I'll talk about Jeff Hinton's famous proclamation back in 2016 that we really should stop training radiologists at that point. So we've seen this sort of story before in terms of these different cycles around artificial intelligence and how they impact clinical practice, and they actually impact jobs and how people come into these different roles. So you'll see me kind of weaving a story across imaging, across clinical medicine, and even some around the larger US economy over the last couple of years. And hopefully what it draws a story of is that we are obviously in a time of tremendous upheaval, tremendous change. We have a technology which at the bench, the lab bench, is doing incredible things. And yet our ability to bring it to the bedside, hence the title, is still bumpy, right? So on the one hand, you can work with these models on your laptop or in the lab, and you can sort of generate incredible AUCs. And from some of the other talks that we've seen today, up until recently, what we've mostly seen are vignettes or samples or patient actors, and I'll show some of those studies. So we're still trying to figure out how do we bring these to the bedside in order to either make our patients healthier, reduce the costs of what it takes to deliver care, reduce the number of errors that we have, or maybe reduce the burnout amongst clinicians. And that mission is still in front of us, and while we have a lot of hope for AI to be able to carry that out, I want two things. I want many things in life. I want to continue to practice. Like, I like seeing patients. So I get nervous around the dialogue that maybe AI is going to replace me as a physician. Like, I viscerally feel that fear. I'd like to continue to practice. I'd like AI to make things better, but I think we have to make sure that we're not falling victim to a lot of hope and we stay grounded really in the research. And so a lot of what I'm going to talk about today is grounded in my own mission to try to say, what is going on in the literature? What do we see? The good, the bad, and the ugly? And what are the publication biases that are even out there that I'll kind of get into? Because I think that sort of informs some of what we're talking about. I see Dr. Nina Kotler here. She's like one of my best friends, she'll hear her keynote tomorrow. I was gonna say, it's a pretty casual environment, so if you wanna stop me or just wave, or if you wanna throw something, you're gonna probably have to get closer than the way you are right now, but hopefully we'll make it fun and we'll have some time for talking at the end. So in the end, as I met, some of the easy objectives that I have is I always like people to understand the difference between predictive AI and generative AI, because generative AI is what's causing sort of a lot of the buzz today. But yet in medicine, we've had more time to really spend looking at predictive models and being able to hopefully predict disease. And then I'm going to talk around like how we're starting to see generative AI impact medicine as a whole, and maybe try to sort through some of these confusing patterns where we're seeing powerful things again at the bench, but maybe some shortcomings at the bedside. This is a simple graphic that I made a while back, and I'm not gonna spend a lot of time in this audience, but it lets everybody remember that we use a lot of words interchangeably, particularly if you get outside of the data science realm. And we have this very large element of something that we call artificial intelligence. And at its simplest state, artificial intelligence is just where we have a machine doing something that humans do. It can listen, it can talk, it can read, or something like that. But there are examples of artificial intelligence that have no improvement with more data. And if anybody remembers the original ELISA, probably most of you don't, but ELISA was this computer program from like the 1970s, 1980s that mimicked psychotherapy, and it never got better. No matter how much data you put into it, it kind of like had the same stochastic response, right? So there are some examples of that, but we have, I'll go through some examples of machine learning, and then we'll get into deep learning, and obviously a lot of the conversation today is around generative AI and large language models. So it's, I try to make the point to lay audiences that oftentimes when you look at AI, it feels like magic, and in my mind, it's really math, right? It's mathematics, and a mathematics that many of us are familiar with is linear regression. Like linear regression is something that most of us have worked with, but this is an example of machine learning because your curve fit gets better when you give it more data. And so this is something that I find that people can get their heads around, but there are other forms of machine learning that are out there that we've actually heard about today from, say, gradient boosting or decision trees or whatnot. So this is just examples of simple machine learning. It turns out that then we can get more advanced, then we have deep learning, right? And so deep learning, I love this example because this is about how the level of my mind, this is as much math as my mind can handle, but the concept of around deep learning is where I'm starting to stack different mathematical equations on top of each other, and depending on their outputs, right, I can go down different arms. And so I can start to create lots of nodes, and it turns out if I do a lot of that, I can do really powerful image recognition. So this is just an example of computer vision where I can look at a picture and I can identify certain things like a car and a horse, a dog, or a person. And when this came out, when ImageNet back in around 2012 and Fei-Fei Li's original work there, when these convolutional neural networks came out, this sort of like ushered in what I think is sort of the modern era of in medicine of us beginning to think about machines taking over what we do. One of the things that I think is interesting about computer vision, and we heard this in the prior talk, is that while we both agree that when I look at that pickup truck, I see a truck and the computer sees a truck, we actually are seeing different things. This is very difficult mental model to get around, but an example that I like to show is this famous picture of, if you look on the far left, there's a panda, and we all look at that, and even I think like that's a panda. If I take this specially crafted image in the middle, that is just noise, and I merge those two images together, on the right, I don't know about you, but I still see a panda. Like that image on the right is a panda. But to a convolutional neural network, it now looks like a gibbon. And that begins to show you that the CNN is looking at different things than we are looking at. And a lot of people, like, this is hard to get at, but there's a biological equivalent to this for those of you all that are clinicians. And you may know this story of a Scottish nurse who could smell patients with Parkinson's disease. Now, if I tell most medical students that there's an olfactory test for Parkinson's disease, they would tell you, you're crazy. There's no way. But it turned out she came from a family of hyperasthmatic people. I'm probably not pronouncing that, but you probably know what I'm talking about. Her family was incredibly sensitive to smells. And so she noticed that her husband, who was a pediatrician, had a certain smell, but as he developed Parkinson's, he smelled different. She didn't make much of it. She was sad about losing her husband. Her husband passed away, and she went to a support group of Parkinsonian patients, and she noticed that everyone in the room had the same smell. And so she ended up working with a group of scientists, and what they identified is that there's a biomarker in the fatty acid of sebum of Parkinsonian patients that we just couldn't pick up before. And this is the same thing that the convolutional neural networks are picking up information encoded in the image that we can't see. And previous speakers have talked about, like, one of the things that's interesting in radiology when we talk about the heterogeneity of the data sets, oftentimes a plain film that comes from two different manufacturers may look exactly the same to us, but in fact there can be, the neural network can perceive that there's information encoded in them. There's actually some really interesting work going on in terms of like image sets that we think are de-identified. There may be encoded information in them that allow us to figure out what hospital they came from, what machines they were generated on. There's a lot of hidden information. And before you think it's crazy, this is just an example of just when one thing can perceive stuff that others can't, we usually think they're crazy at first until we understand the science behind it. We've heard today already around the power of computer vision to sort of extract clinical information from our patients. And I think this is a really exciting area because as much as we're talking about cutting edge models being able to do advanced decision support, what if we're able to fundamentally screen our patients with very simple, inexpensive tests? think about an ECG, a retinal image, and maybe a blood smear, because to my knowledge, I haven't seen any papers, and I keep waiting for someone to try to extract what's the information in a peripheral blood smear. Pretty cheap test. These are three image sets, right, that we collect all the time in medicine, and yet there's a ton of diagnostic information that we can extract from them. From our nephrology lecture earlier today, we heard about how CKD could be diagnosed from retinal images and how you can even determine the difference between diabetic and non-diabetic exams. So to me, very interesting. Also interesting, you start to get into a diagnosis of something like fibromyalgia, right? Another controversial area, but the fact that we're finding neural imprint, that there's data encoded in the optical disc that's tracking to fibromyalgia, I think is a really fascinating piece. And it, again, might give us insights into illnesses that up until now we really haven't been able to get our hands around. I think one of the more famous examples of computer vision was this article that came out in the Annals of Internal Medicine last year, which again said that if you try to do cardiovascular risk stratification on patients, and historically we use demographics similar to, like in the old days, the Framingham criteria, right, to be able to assess people's cardiovascular risk. But it turns out that if you add a chest X-ray to that and deep learning algorithms, you can further risk stratify those patients. And again, here's another example where if I walked up to, I'll ask Dr. Kotler if she can, like, if you can, like, how good you are at screening, assessing cardiovascular risk from chest X-rays, because most radiologists would say that's not really what they're designed to do, right? But again, fascinating study that there's information encoded in that. So somebody that, like, where I think this begins to be really helpful is somebody that comes out as intermediate from our traditional demographic studies. Now we can use a very inexpensive test to further risk stratify them. So something really powerful. Another study that I think is important to recognize just from a historical perspective, this article in Nature that came out in 2024, I believe, was the first randomized control trial that I'm aware of that was able to show that using a predictive algorithm to reduce mortality. And I think this will become interesting at the end of the study where we talk about how do we insert AI in workflow, because this was a very blunt instrument. This was a tool that was operating in a hospital in Asia, and essentially it was looking at ECG tracings. And if it found patterns that were associated with later clinical demise, it would send a text message to the doctor, and it would say, go check on your patients. That's all it said. We're going to talk later around like how valuable a sort of a generic message is. It actually causes a lot of workflow problems. But nonetheless, in the study, that was enough for the clinicians to go review their patients and actually take interventions that reduce mortality. So I thought these are all great examples of very practical things that we're seeing in healthcare today that we can begin to really change the way that we practice. So we've talked a lot around predictive AI. Many of you all are familiar with that. I'm going to begin to switch the content to talk about generative AI because it's really fascinating on how we're able to kind of create new content that wasn't there before. So I'll go pretty quickly because I'm assuming everybody in the room is very familiar with generative AI. You can do parlor tricks like ask ChatGPT to make a rap out of the Krebs cycle, which is one of my favorite things to do with it. Or what I can do is now I can make a movie like with Sora. And the point that I try to make for audiences that have never seen generative AI before is that this is, none of these people are real. This never existed, right? I can now create an entire visual element that never existed before. But there are issues that we talk about with generative pieces around the issues of hallucination. And I think hallucinations are a really fascinating thing. I'll point out humans hallucinate frequently. When you look in the literature, and I'll talk about this in a little bit, when you look at how humans do when we do summarizations of the EHR, we actually can find hallucinations there. But I like this image when I asked Midjourney for a CT scan that shows a massive hemispheric stroke. The radiologists in the room and the clinicians in the room immediately look at that and they go, that's clearly not a CT scan. I don't know what it is. But what's interesting is, like, again, when we talk about how these models try to be very authoritative, to a lay audience when I show this, they all think that it's accurate, right? Because it looks brain-like and it's got this stroke stuff. It's just not like what a classic example would be. And so this is just sort of a tangible piece of like why we continue to worry about hallucinations in terms of inserting sort of erroneous things into our medical thinking. So today, when I think about generative AI, there are three big areas that I'm seeing adopted in our organization and we can see in the literature. The first piece is we'll talk about in-basket draft messages. We heard a little bit about that earlier today. And one of the things that I think is really interesting about this is that there's really good data that when we use large language language models, you can measure the length of the messages. They're much longer, usually about 4 times longer. The language is richer. And most patients, now in many, many studies, will rate them as about 10 times more empathetic than the physician. And I think that's a really interesting concept that we'll come back to in a minute. There's mixed results in terms of whether these LLMs are saving physician time. I'll show you some data that's from our organization that we think we're saving about a minute per message. It's not going to change the world, but it is helpful. Other places, it hasn't been able to show quite as much. There does seem to be a pretty clear reduction in cognitive load. And we know that cognitive load can be a predictor of burnout. And so I think that that's important. One of the things I'm most excited about with generative AI sort of being brought into clinical practice is EMR summarization. And I don't know how many of you all have started to use it. Like, for a while, we were having problems where people were just copying the whole chart into the public chat GPT, and then we just tell them, like, please don't do that. Like, you shouldn't be using public models there. But now that the LLMs are sort of embedded in the chart, there are several studies that show that the models are as good, if not better, than humans. And there's a couple of references here. And this is where we start to see examples where humans hallucinate. When they do chart summarizations, you'll find the hallucinations. And it's not unlike if any of you all were clinically facing in your residency, your post-call, you're kind of tired, you're doing your HPI presentation the next morning. We've all seen, like, our residents sort of like insert things erroneously that really weren't there. So I think it's an interesting piece. And then we'll talk about ambient documentation as well, which up until a few months ago, whenever I gave a talk about ambient, I just said, you know, it's the data, like, we're all spending a ton of money on this thing. Our physicians really like it, but we don't have a lot of good outcome data. I'm going to go through the Kaiser paper that came out recently. I think that's starting to change my view in terms of how I think about ambient. So I think most people are probably pretty familiar with how LLMs are doing in-basket messaging. This is an example redacted from our organization. You have an incoming message that comes in, the LLM creates a draft response, and then the physician edits that response, and we send it out the door. So in general, I don't think many places are automatically sending messages out. We're just trying to give the physician sort of a head start in crafting. And we believe that cognitively it may be easier to edit a message than to come up with one. And there's also the ability to start mining the chart. In this case, you can sort of see that the LLM sort of noted that Xanax wasn't even on the patient's list of medications, right? So you can start to insert a little bit of reasoning into that. And some of our data shows that in the pink, there are the people who are not using these tools, in the blue that they are. It saves maybe about a minute per message, but that builds up over time. At our organization, we have a particularly large challenge with the amount of in-basket messaging coming into our clinicians. So we're trying to do everything we can to make things better for them. So I talked earlier about the ambient scribe data, and up until recently, again, we saw maybe some reduction in cognitive load, a lot of satisfaction, but this New England Journal article that came out recently really, I think, brings a couple of points forward. And I don't have a pointer, but I'll draw I'll just stay up here. What's interesting about this data set is, so Kaiser started early on with their first vendor. And what you see on the blue curve at the top is you see an adoption curve that plateaus. And it plateaus because they decided they were going to switch vendors, and they decided not to bring more people on. And then when you see the blue curve go up again, that's because they've now brought on their second vendor. The point being here that they have this interesting sort of two-phase, almost a year and a half experience with using generative with ambient tools, and they're getting to fairly large volumes by the end of that period of time. And what you see here is this I'll walk you through what this chart shows, but I think there's a lot of important information here. The top curve in blue were the people who generally chose to use these tools were people who were slower in doing their charts, right? So if you look at the y-axis, it's minutes of time per note. And I can't see it from here, but I think it's around four plus minutes in the blue. So what they did, kind of intuitively, they said people that take more time in their charts, maybe you are the ones who should be using this tool. Well, I think that makes a lot of sense. The other lines that you see are sort of like the median or the average users, right? So you can see that the people who were sort of targeted to use ambient tools were ones that were significantly slower. The first blue arrow that's pointing up is when they initiated their first ambient tool, and you see a phenomenon where the time in the chart in that blue line comes down. It comes down to the median, and now that group starts to track like everybody else. But what's interesting about this is then they implement a second vendor now, and then they scale up with a lot more users, and you get a secondary effect where now all of a sudden the people who are using the tool who were the least productive before now appear to be more productive than the median. I think that's very interesting for a couple of points. Number one, it took them over a year to get to this. It also took them to get to very large scale. And I think that's important because most people, myself included, IT reports up to me, I have budgetary responsibility for that. These tools can be expensive. So what you want to do is say, ooh, I only want to roll it out in this pilot and I want to see that it works and I want to get some ROI before I scale it. That's a natural thing. But this Kaiser paper suggests you may have to go long and big to get these impacts, that maybe there's some sort of effect from physicians talking to each other, working from each other, adopting to this technology. This may be an interesting case where the pilot is not going to be able to show the value. So nonetheless, I think a really important study that came out. The other thing that was interesting to this is they're now starting to report things in the green is positive, the red is negative, and you can start to look at things like they asked patients on their experience. And in general, patients said the following things, which was reassuring. They noticed the physicians were spending more time looking at them. Some physicians have said, well, that's not a problem. I don't have a problem with not looking at my patients enough, but the patients noticed this. And the other thing at the bottom is that most patients did not mind having the AI present. Some do. And what's interesting is actually patients who are voice actors or film actors tend to be very sensitive about this topic. And I think it drives from OpenAI using a voice for their tool that was very close to Scarlett Johansson's voice, you know, from her. And so you're starting to see like a class of people that are nervous around these tools that maybe they're going to get their either their identity or sort of the way that they earn their living is being taken away. Well, I'm going to switch here and say a lot of people say, okay, that's a lot of cool stuff that's going on. But what's going to happen? What's going to happen, Dr. Whitfield? And I get asked this all the time, and I say I use much more graphic terms in one-on-one conversations, but we stink at forecasting how technology impacts in healthcare. And I think we need to learn from this because we've been doing this mistake for a long time. So this is a quote from President Obama back in 2009, the American Recovery Investment Act, which was we were going to have a massive adoption of EHR records across the United States. We were going to bring down costs and save lives. Now, as someone who practices in EMR and runs a hospital in EMR, like when we lose the EMR, we don't see patients anymore. Like we are totally dependent on it. But if you look at the data, if you look at all the articles, there's no data that shows there's any improvement in productivity. In fact, except for billing RVUs. Billing RVUs is the only thing we've ever been shown that the EHRs is able to do. And there was this famous photo from JAMA back in 2011 of an ophthalmologist using the EHR who's, you know, the child perceiving that the physician's no longer looking at the patient, right? So this has caused a lot of angst. I'm not saying EMRs are bad. It's just that we thought that investing in EMRs across the United States would change the cost curve, and we haven't been able to see that. Well, there are other famous predictions, and by the way, I want to say that Jeff Hinton is like way smarter than I am, and I don't fault him for making this comment, but we know that back in 2016, you know, he made this very powerful comment around the impact that convolutional neural networks are going to have on radiologists. And I'm going to show you how we're repeating this pattern again, where we believe something is going to happen, and it has impacts on the job market, and then we get into trouble afterwards. So the example would be, Professor Hinton makes this comment, this is what happens to radiology matches the next year, right? So people are like, I'm not going to go into that profession because like I'm going to get replaced by a machine, right? So you can see the PGY2 matches drop pretty significantly. But now we're in a place where we have a massive shortage of radiologists. And it's multifactorial. It's not just because we don't have enough people. We're producing more images than ever. But it shows you that our ability to predict this is very, very hard. Now, there's some other predictions that are going on right now. Famous CEOs of Salesforce who are basically saying, we don't need to hire, you know, I don't need to hire software people anymore because I've got AI tools. And we are seeing this in the job market. So this is a really fascinating paper. I think this is the one that comes, this one's from Stanford. So they're looking at the job growth in different age brackets. And so what you see on the left-hand side is, this is for software developers. The upper curve is essentially, the curve that you don't see drop off are senior people, people like me, people over the age of 50, and there really hasn't been a decrease in that headcount in the software industry. But the younger you get, you see a dramatic drop off in the number of headcount, because the software companies have decided that they don't need young folks anymore, right? They can use these tools to replace, they can use AI tools in order to replace sort of entry-level workers. And we actually see this in other industries, like in customer service. This is another example where, again, a separate study, this one comes out of Harvard, the purple line on top is hiring amongst, quote, senior folks, not senior like 55, but like more advanced in their career. And you can look at the plummet of hiring amongst more junior staff that really happens in the GPT era. And this is happening across multiple different industries. And if I talk to software coders, many of them will tell me they can be 30, 40% more productive using these tools. So it makes sense that, you know, maybe we would need to do some less hiring, but there's some interesting counter noise to this that I'll throw out there that just makes me pause. The first piece is, this is a paper that everybody's talking about, and I'm not defending it. It's just, it's a provocative paper that kind of came out in collaboration with MIT, and it basically said across the United States, we're adopting billions of dollars of AI, and most people are failing to get good use out of it. Like all these companies are pouring all this money into AI, and it's very hard to find sort of return that we can identify from it. So that's a little bit concerning. Like, if we're not hiring people across multiple different industries because we don't need junior people anymore, why are we not starting to see this, you know, pop up in sort of profit and loss within companies? This is another very provocative paper that I found that looks at a potential phenomena that might be going on here. So this is essentially looking at an open source software development company where they tried to estimate the efficiency improvement that would come from adopting different AI tools. And they looked at, the first one that you see on the far left is they asked economists to estimate the degree of improvement. And you see about a 30% improvement, like just what I quoted. Then you ask a machine learning expert, how much improvement are you going to get? And then you get this level. And then you look at the developers before they did like a time motion study and afterwards. And the bottom line is, in every place, everybody said, we're going to get a ton of productivity improvement from this. And then, you know what they did? They implemented it and they measured it, and productivity goes down. And my point is not that technology is bad or AI is never going to work, but it is not a slam dunk. And we've seen this over and over and over before. And I think probably Dr. Kotler is probably going to talk a little bit around, it's like the way you implement the technology matters so much more than just having the technology around. And we have yet to really figure this out. And I worry, because we're all rushing in to get the technology. And we'll talk a little bit more around a topic, that a word that I did not know until Dr. Chung brought it up earlier, and that is cyborg psychology. But I'll talk a little bit about that in a minute here. So where are we going with this? And I think there's a lot of interesting debate in terms of like how humans and AI should be working together. I started off this talk by saying, like, I really, am I out of time? No, I've got plenty of time. Good. I like look down, I'm like at the top of the hour, like, it could not have gone that fast. I started off the top of this hour saying, like, I really enjoy seeing patients. I want to continue to see patients. I have a natural bias to say that, like, human doctors should see patients because I really like doing it and I don't want to be replaced. But we have to be sort of honest in sort of looking at the literature. So I try to, like, do a little bit of unpacking of what do we see out there. So I have a good friend, Kurt Langlotz, who, after Professor Hinton made his famous comment, Kurt went to RSNA in 2017, and he basically said, no, the reality is, it's not that AI is going to replace us as physicians, it's just that radiologists who use AI will replace those who don't. And by the way, I like that idea. It's a soothing idea. What's interesting is, I know Dr. Kotler and I don't totally agree on this, there are more and more examples where we are seeing that human physician and AI aren't working together the way we thought, or we need to rethink the way we function together. And I think actually a lot of it, what's interesting is when I try to find out, well, where's the computer science grounding in that humans plus AI should work best together? I think it comes from chess. And so I'm not, is anybody in here a chess player? Like, because I'm about to like embarrass myself. Oh, I've got one. So I've got to be careful about this. So I think many of us remember that when Deep Blue beat Garry Kasparov in the late 1990s, it was sort of a seminal event, I mean, sort of in the chess world. And you could kind of march, you could look at sort of from the 80s on using in chess, you could see as the computer algorithms were getting better and better, more and more like it, only a few experts could kind of continue to win. This was a big moment when all of a sudden the human lost to the machine. But what happened is we entered into this era called cyborg chess afterwards. And in the era of cyborg chess, a human chess player, usually really good, using a machine could always beat other humans and could beat other machines. So it brought this idea that maybe that's where sort of cyborg performance could come from. The interesting question is does chess become the model for everything else? And I think medicine is probably more complex than that. So I began to question, like, how well do we work together? I like this paper that Eric Topol and his colleagues put out a little while back, and I would just draw your attention to the right-hand side in the total. And what this was a systematic review of AI sort of versus other control groups. And in the top row, you have AI versus clinician, and you say there's 8 studies. This is as of a year ago. In the middle row, AI versus routine care, 20 studies. And at the bottom, AI-assisted clinician versus unassisted clinician, 58. So what you see is in our own literature, we're not looking very often at AI versus human. Like, we have this bias where we're always trying, we're like, we naturally want to look at like AI plus humans. And I think that reflects our own interest in wanting to probably have that be the answer. And by the way, I want that to be the answer too, but we shouldn't let it bias maybe how we're organizing our papers. A couple of interesting examples of things that sort of freak me out when I look at like these tools. This is Google's AIMEE, which came out as an open source, as a preprint a while back, finally got published back in April. AIMEE is really interesting, right? Because this is another artificial situation where they have AIMEE, and AIMEE is working with, they take patient actors. So those of you all that have gone to medical school in more recent times, you know that there are patients that learn how to, they know how to like present with diseases like gallstone pain or appendicitis or whatnot. So it's not a real world situation, but those patient actors are pretty good. And so they had the patient actors interact with primary care physicians like me or AIMEE, and then they would, the patient actors would rate AIMEE or the physician on skills like, do I trust this thing? Or do I feel like they were empathetic, like those pieces? And then they had specialists rate the answers to see how accurate they were. And long story short, what you see from the spider graph is in every situation, AIMEE was better than the primary care physicians. Like, I'm bummed about that. I don't like want AIMEE to come and like replace what I do, because I think what I do is sacred, but it's a little bit concerning, right? That maybe, so I'm like, okay, well, that's just AIMEE. Like, we can move on from there. Here's another paper which looks at a large language model and looking at cognitive behavioral therapy and delivering cognitive behavioral therapy. And again, with some case vignettes, so not in clinical practice. I don't think people are ready to like take patients that are suicidal or schizophrenic or have depression or anxiety and start having them talk to ChatGPT. Although that's absolutely happening out in the wild, we're seeing that. In this case, what we saw was actually the large language models might be using CBT better than the therapist. So like, this is an example of behavioral health where the large language models appear to do pretty well in this at least artificial situation. Well, then I thought, well, it's not like really hard. Like, these are just like sort of like weird abstract things. Then this paper comes out, which is the one that I think everybody saw, where you took 20 years of the New England Journal of Clinical Path Correlation Conferences. Like, any of those of you tried to do those, they are really hard. Like, whenever I want to feel stupid, I like read through one of those cases and I never get it on the differential. Like, these are really hard cases. But what you see here on the top was, and this is the reasoning model of GPT, it's now been replaced, but the reasoning model did much better than GPT-4, which did much better than attending physicians, which did much better than residents. Now again, these are CPC cases. This is not like real life delivering care. But again, we start getting this signal that there are these tools that seem to be doing better than us in a number of situations. And if you dig into the AIMEE paper, I'm gonna study more on the right one. This is actually buried only in their supplemental information. It's not published in the main paper. But what they do, what I wanna call your attention to is they show performance curves, like how far down in your differential before you got the right answer. The top curve is AIMEE alone, the red curve. The orange curve is the clinician plus Amy. That's what we wanted to be the best one. Then you have like the clinician using Google or UpToDate or some other search tool and the clinician alone. So again, artificial situation, but another signal that it may not be, at least in this situation, that the human physician plus the AI performs better than AI alone. I'm not a radiologist. My wife is a radiologist, so I do this next study really carefully. But this study that comes out of Sweden, which looked at AI's ability to do screening mammography, what was really interesting about this, in my opinion, is not the AI's ability to do cancer detection, which is important. It was really close, very close statistically. But if you looked at the false positive rate of AI compared to human, it was way better. Now, we can talk about the dangers of false positive rates in a number of other settings, but mammography is a really interesting use case because what we know is there was also a paper in the Annals of Internal Medicine that came out recently that basically said that when a woman gets a false positive mammogram, there's like a 40% chance that she's going to drop out of, I'm sorry, there's a 10% chance she's going to drop out of screening altogether. So false positive mammograms end up with women leaving the screening cohorts. And so, like, I don't think it's as benign as we think. There's also a huge amount of psychological trauma that goes with it. So, again, in each of these situations, we have humans and AI perks that are performing at different levels, and it begins to call into question, we definitely need to learn when should we be using human and when should we be using AI. My radiology friends also don't like this paper, but I found this to be very sobering, kind of like a canary in the coal mine. This was a paper that was published in JAMA at the end of last year. This comes out of China, and this was looking at the impact of using AI in radiologists and measuring their burnout scores. Now, at the beginning, I talked about it would be great if AI made my life better, right? We are losing clinicians left and right. People are leaving the field because the amount of burnout that they're experiencing, the overload that they have. So it's natural to think that AI is going to do the quadruple aim all at once. I want it to do the quadruple aim all at once. I want it to lower costs. I want it to make the clinicians happier, the patients happier, and make the clinical outcomes better. This was a provocative study because actually what this study suggests to me is that the AI increased burnout scores in radiologists, and the burnout scores got worse as the workload went up. Now, you can pull this paper apart, you can say it's junk science or whatnot. By the way, it was true whether the radiologist liked AI or didn't like AI. But it gets into that there's something going on between humans and machines and the way that they interact that I don't think we're studying enough. And it gets into some topics of around, for example, when you start looking at this general area, we have different things like automation neglect, automation algorithm aversion, and workflow impacts. And Dr. Chung talked about this in our earlier talk. This is a really fascinating paper that I think starts to maybe get at the root of like, well, what could be going on? How could AI possibly be causing more harm than good? Well, it turns out in this paper, they studied two different ways of reporting AI findings. In the on the right, in the blue, they used global reporting. They just said, there's an abnormality in the chest x-ray, you need to go look at it. And that's not unlike that ECG study that I showed you at the very beginning, whereas on the left, you gave very localized of like where the AI was finding the abnormality and kind of narrowed it in. And if you look at what in the data behind this, what you can see is on the far left, the amount of time that clinicians spend when you localize the finding is less than when you create just a global alert. And we're starting to see the signal that when you add AI to clinician workflow, it actually makes their time longer. I'll show you another study in a second. Like it may be adding to a workflow, not reducing it. But if you can do it the right way, like if you do it the wrong way, not only you add time, but you're adding time like and making them frustrated and slow. If you do it the right way, you can get a much better sort of outcome. By the way, it was interesting that it didn't matter whether the AI was correct or incorrect. Just the way you presented it, it had much more of an impact. There was a paper that came out pretty recently from OpenAI on the PendaCare, which is in Africa. And I don't know if anybody, I'm sure most of you read this paper. To me, this is a really exciting paper because it begins to show that there are ways to introduce LLMs into workflow that are having really dramatic effects. So in this case, I believe, if I remember correctly, this is in Nairobi. This is a medical center that's had a long history of having an EMR, and they've been trying different decision support tools. They had a really large data set. They had like about 90,000 visits. They had a lot of documentation outcomes to look at what was actually happening. And here's an important figure. 74% of the clinicians in this said that this made them better. I think that is a really important signal. Like when clinicians say it makes them better, like that's something that I listen to. But the time in the chart, and the time in the chart goes up and the notes get longer. So again, we're not seeing the quadruple aim coming from AI, but we can see in this case clinical benefit. The way that this worked was pretty ingenious. As the clinician, like somebody like me is taking a history, there's just a simple stoplight reporting, red, green, yellow. If it's reading my history taking and everything looks okay, it stays green and I just keep going along. If it looks like I'm missing something, like somebody said that they've got, I think there's more internists or like primary care folks here, so somebody describes that they're like short of breath, but I didn't ask about like if they had any orthopnea, like it says, hey, you might wanna like ask about this. So if you're missing things from your history, it gives you like a little yellow, or if you to suggest like you should look at something, if you completely miss something really important, it gives you a red, and you can click on it and it'll tell you what you're missing. It does this for other areas like what diagnostic tests should you order and what therapeutic tests you should order. And so what was interesting around this is that very simple intervention, red, green, yellow, those different parts of the clinical care, what you start to see is that the number of errors that were seen in the delivery of care start to go down. The orange lines are the AI, the blue are the non-AI. So across each of these areas, you can measure a decrease in the actual error rate. That's pretty dramatic. What's even more interesting is the effect on the clinicians over time. Because they trust this tool and they like this tool, remember 74% said they liked it. If you measure the orange line is the percentage of sort of charts left in a red status, i.e. the chart being left with either on the history, the diagnosis, the treatment, or the plan, that there was something really wrong missing. What you see in the blue is without AI, the clinicians stay pretty much the same. But in the orange, you see the physicians beginning to learn. And actually, by the end of the study, many more of their charts are left with, you know, only in the green or the yellow category. And what this tells me is that you're starting to see the AI being able to, in my opinion, positively shape clinician behavior. We talked earlier in the previous lecture around the de-skilling article that came out around gastroenterologists doing colonoscopies and are they losing the ability to look at things. But this is actually a really positive thing of like we can actually sort of it's almost like reinforcement learning for our clinicians. So moving ahead, you know, I don't know where we're going in this space, and I think we all do a lousy job of predicting where we're going in this space. But I really liked this article from Benia et al. In the New England Journal of Medicine, talking about Moravec's paradox. And this is an older idea around there are certain things that humans are better at, and there's certain things that robots or machines are better at. And if you think about empathy through a text box, the LLMs are good. But if you think about bedside medicine, and the context switching and delivering empathy in that setting, like it's clear that humans do much better. And how do we know that? Remember during COVID, we were trying to deliver, it's horrible, we were trying to deliver care to patients in isolation wards with like iPads, complete disconnection, right? And people were dying, they were going through critical illness with only this sort of like artificial experience. And the amount of trauma that caused for a lot of folks, it reminds us that like until we get sort of like full form robots that completely like replace who we are, there's something still very powerful about being at the bedside or touching somebody. It may be different for telemedicine, but in terms of being in person, there's still something very powerful. There's also a context switching that we continue to see, like even with ambient, like oftentimes in our clinical scenarios, particularly more inpatient than outpatient, there's a lot of context switching that's going on in these conversations, and it can be hard for the machines to pull that apart. Obviously, physical dexterity and exams, when you're trying to like listen to the lungs and the heart piece, and I already talked about the contextual piece, but there's lots of stuff where AI is really good at. We talked earlier about it could be medical education, but I continue to get really excited about the summarization piece because today, I don't have continuity with my patients, so when I go to see my patients in my practice, I'm generally seeing someone that's got 10 years of history in our EMR, and I have 3 minutes to look at it. And it's a very scary experience. I look through the problem list and the last note. But the ability of the LLM to go through, I'm sure it's not perfect, but I stank at it even more. The ability to give me that nice summarization of what's going on makes me feel so much better, because when I go in to talk to the patient, I'm not going in totally blind, and I still talk to my patients. Like, I think that's really important, but I feel like I can now talk to my patients much more better armed about what we're talking about. So we've talked a lot about AI, and many of our organizations, we have this sense that we need to adopt this as fast as possible. But there's this interesting article from the literature which tries to ask clinicians, what do they think about AI? And it turns out that there's some clinicians that are really excited about AI, some clinicians are really worried about it, but across the board, nurses and physicians are very worried about autonomy. Autonomy is a very sensitive issue amongst our clinical workforce. And the reason why I think we need to think about autonomy as being a critical piece that we have to pay attention to, despite our excitement around what AI might do, is what happened with Luddites. So you might remember, Luddites were craft workers in the 19th century who were really good at their skill. And as the Industrial Revolution came out, they began to develop a dislike for the machines. They didn't dislike the machines because they were replacing them by jobs. They didn't like the machines because they felt like the quality was not there. And this reminds me of last summer in front of the Kaiser Permanente offices, where nurses were protesting around the use of AI because they felt that their autonomy and that their clinical decision making was being interrupted by the deployment of AI. And so this is a reminder of the way humans respond to dramatic technical change. And if we don't manage that change in an empathetic way and a way where we listen to our clinicians, we may come out with a great model that is able to like do diagnosis and treatment at a lower cost and with less errors. But if we alienate the clinical workforce in the meantime, like, we're gonna have a really big trouble. So this is a reminder that for all of the excitement around these tools, and I'm super excited about them, I'm a little bit scared of them too, we need to remember this sort of change management piece and staying close to our clinicians to make them part of the a part of this process, not the end. So I kind of think about, you know, we're at this stage where it's not unlike, you know, when Galileo started to suggest that maybe the Earth was not the center of the world. That's what you see on the upper right-hand side. There was a period of time in medicine where we were sure that the four humors were like everything that we needed to know. It turned out that germs were probably more important to know about than bile and phlegm and those kind of things. So we're at this transition point where AI is beginning to change what we think it is to be a physician, to be even a human, and sort of the basic fundamentals under which we sort of underpin how we see the world are being shaken. But this is the time when more than ever, we need to be looking at published studies. I'm not bemoaning white papers and pitches and anecdotal experience, but with this degree of uncertainty, with this degree of change, I think it's really critical to stay grounded in what the literature is telling us, because it's going to prevent us from burning a lot of time and money pursuing things that aren't achieving results. We want them to. We hope that they will. But it's only the literature that will tell us whether these things are really reproducible. With that, I think we've got a couple of minutes. Nobody threw anything, which I'm really happy about. Maybe I missed something. So I'm happy to take questions. Obviously, I'll be here later. I think we have a reception later. We have to talk then. So thank you very much, and please ask whatever you'd like.
Hey, everybody. John here. Thanks for listening to another episode. If you enjoyed what you heard here today, please check us out on our website, www.AmericanCollegeAIM.org. Sign up today to become a member. And don't forget to save the dates, October 9th and October 10th, 2026, here in Chicago at McCormick Place Convention Center. We're having our second annual scientific session. Special shout out to everybody who joined us in 2025. You all made it amazing. Thanks so much for coming. We hope to see you all next year. Don't forget to sign up right away. www.AmericanCollegeAIM.org. We'll see you then.